And again, thanks to Dr. John Ward, live out there in Egypt. And Scott Roberts is still with us. We're going to talk with him about the Ark of the Covenant when we come back and take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Scott Roberts with us, the Exodus Reality, the latest work. We'll get calls in just a second. They're lining up here for you, Scott. But I've got to get your take on the Ark of the Covenant.
All right. Well, the Ark of the Covenant, much ado about that little box. From Raiders of the Lost Ark in pop culture to religious relics found in Ethiopia. This is what is interesting about Moses. Remember when I said that I believe Moses was thoroughly Egyptian or Egyptianized? I'm Scott and Welsh by blood, but I'm thoroughly American. This is what Moses was. He brought with him all sorts of things from Egyptian culture and religion and spirituality. One of them, when he had them build the Ark of the Covenant, this is nothing other than an Egyptian bark shrine, which everywhere John and I went in Egypt, every temple wall we looked on, every engraving, even down to graffiti that was scratched into the walls of the actual inscriptions, you find pictures of the bark shrine. At Luxor Temple and at Karnak Temple, we had inscriptions of priests, high priests, shaved bald, carrying a box that looked exactly like the Ark of the Covenant on a little boat with staves over their shoulders carrying this thing. This was the embodiment of the gods was there. This was a spiritual part of their culture. And when Moses devised the box of the Ark of the Covenant, it was nothing other than a reproduction of the bark shrine. As a matter of fact, the Bible talks about, and there were two cherubs on either end spreading their wings over it. On the Egyptian barks like this, these shrines, you would see those. Sometimes they would be built out in three dimensions, but other times they were simply engraved on the ends, these winged beings spreading their wings on either end of the box. And so the Ark of the Covenant, whether it had supernatural qualities all on its own, that it was a charger, some people say, and an electrical device and things. We don't know that for sure. There's no way to prove that existed that way. But what we do know historically is that it was an Egyptian invention. Same thing with the temple. You look at temple in Jerusalem that was built, the first temple built by Solomon, what we know of all the temples that were built there, Herod's temple being the last and the Wailing Wall today being the remnants of the foundation of his temple. The temple layout, when they were in the wilderness prior to getting to the promised land, they built a big tented version with upright staves to put up curtains for the outer court of this huge temple. And then the temple itself, or the tabernacle, was built out of tents. And they had the holy place, and then the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant dwelt. And you had all the implements of worship, the laver, the place of washing, the altar for sacrifice. These are all exact copies of the kinds of temples you find in Egypt. There were so many little temples we walked into where we walked back into the Holy of Holies.
Great influence there.
Yes. That is what Moses brought with him, what he grew up with.
Well, what about the discussion, Scotty, about if somebody touched the Ark of the Covenant, they could die?
Now, this was something that was written about in the Hebrew Book of Faith. And we don't know if it really had that quality other than by faith to accept that story is true. And I would say, as a person of faith that has gone up and down a little roller coastery of late, but I would look at that and say, by faith, I can believe that story is true because God said he dwelt there and he gave that command, you don't touch the thing or you'll die, and that people died. But that's part of the faith story. What was the thing really? It was a box. It was a bark shrine. So did it really have those qualities? We don't know. There's no way of knowing for sure unless we find the Ark of the Covenant. And they say they've got the Ark of the Covenant somewhere in Jerusalem. There's a
Or Ethiopia. Some say a church in Ethiopia.
If it had those qualities back then, it probably wouldn't have them now because it was supposed to be the presence of God that gave it that quality. Remember when Moses dedicates the tabernacle and the ark, and they march the ark into the tabernacle out in the wilderness, and it says, and before all the people, in the form of a cloud, a bright cloud descending was God's Shekinah glory that settled into the tabernacle and onto the ark. And that's where the Shekinah glory of God settled, which, by the way, all by itself is an interesting term. Shekinah in the Hebrew is a strictly female term. So you could almost literally say the female presence of God, the goddess, descended on the Ark of the Covenant and dwelt there. And I, of course, I get all kinds of bristle for stating that, but that's what it says. The goddess or the female presence of God settled on this box, and that is what gave it its power. But after the presence of God left the Ark, would that power still be in there? Would it still be a charged box? Like Moses' face was said to have shone, that he had to put a veil over his face because his face shined after meeting with God. Did the ark have qualities inherent with it because God dwelt there? Then that takes you all the way back to the question. Did God dwell there, or is that the embellishment? Is that the story? John mentioned again the 72 rabbis. Remember, Israel was carried off into captivity, and the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. And they were held in captivity, and then a few hundred years later, let go, and they were able to go back to their homeland. They were going to rebuild their temple. This is about the time in the 400s B.C. when these rabbis all petitioned Pharaoh, Ptolemy II, to go to the Library of Alexandria and recompile the Old Testament scriptures. And their purpose was to bolster the faithful of Israel and to reestablish the history of Israel for their people, which were noble goals.
Sure.
But I think in the process, remember, look at the way civilization is today. It's not that long ago where spirituality and religion was part of all of our documents. You look at, use the Salem witch trials as an example. How much religious material was used to adjudicate those trials? We would never adjudicate under those bylaws today, because it was all strictly biblical from a biblical sense. So it's not all that long ago, just a few hundred years ago, we were doing the same thing. And back then, when these rabbis recompiled the Old Testament from oral tradition, from some of the writings that were left over, I believe they imbued it with the spirituality, the religion of the Jews, in order to bolster the Jews coming back home. And that was the purpose. So did the Ark of the Covenant actually have this power? You can only accept it by faith. We don't know.
See, what I'm beginning to get, Scott, and we'll take calls. Boy, they're lining up for you.
Uh-oh.
What? No, that's good. That's a good thing. But I'm picking up from you and Dr. John Ward that everything mystical that we see and read in Genesis may not be the case.
Well, now here's the thing. There is the faith, there's the stepping out of the box to examine the facts, which is what we've tried to do. But then we are inextricably drawn back to our faith foundations. I find that I've got to get away from my old mentor, Dr. Charles Ayling, told me when I was writing Nephilim. He says, "Now, Scotty," he says, "don't fall into the trap of becoming like a secular or a secular theologian." He says, "You have to use the Bible as your filter for history." And I said, "But Dr. Ayling, isn't that a mistake? We may believe that by faith, but if I use that as my filter, I'm filtering history through my religion. Shouldn't my religion be filtered from what we know about history?" And he told me, if history doesn't line up to the Bible, then history is wrong. We've got to search for the answer. My take would be, history is pretty solid, well, for the most part. I'm going to get taken to task for that statement, because history can change every day.
Sure.
But you have to make sure your history, that your biblical or your faith beliefs align with what you find out as fact. To quote that great old archaeological sage, Indiana Jones, if you remember in one of the movies, he scrawls on the chalkboard to his class, he says, "Archaeology is the search not for truth, but for fact." He says, if you want truth, go down to so-and-so's philosophy class down the hall. And that's really what this is about with this book, is while we're both, even John said to me at the end of writing this book, and in Egypt when we were there, he says, "Scotty," he says, my faith has been rekindled by this, even though our approach was to take it outside the realm of faith. But I do use the Bible as the basis for my argument and say, does history align with the Bible or not? I didn't squeeze it to fit. I said, does it fit? Is there, and where there is lack of firsthand archaeological and historical data and evidence, you have to go to the secondhand archaeological data and evidence to establish plausibility. And I think we get too hung up on the, we have to have this firsthand information. We don't. There's a lot of history that is established by what is plausible and what is not. And if we discarded every book of faith that we used in our as context in our historical research and studies, we'd lose 98% of our information because almost everything had religious connotation.
To the phones we go. Let's go to east of the Rockies. Mike is in Clinton Township, Michigan. Mike, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hey, Mike. Hey,
good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Excellent.
I want to commend you, gentlemen, on that book. I've been contemplating that for such a long time. I hope that book takes off because that is a great subject. Everything is, to me, has always just been his story. You know, it's never a fact that's based on actual truth. But I wanted to elaborate on something that you guys had put out earlier. Now, which one of you gentlemen talked about the snake?
That was John Ward, but you can address that, Scott.
To talk about that, it was a bit muffled for me to
the
talk
snake,
about
the snake from the,
oh, the
from
snake.
The staff.
The snake from the staff. All I would say is I wrote a book earlier this year that came out, The Secret History of the Reptilians, and it was subtitled Exploring the Connection of the Snake and the Serpent Throughout Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. And I think the snake was a symbol in Egypt of you've got Ptah was the snake. You've got the word is escaping me, the snake that appeared on the crown, all the royal crowns. You've got the serpent symbol was a symbol of life, of circular life. It was one where you would see it like eating itself in the tail, and it would also shed its skin. And George, you pulled up that word for me when I was on with you last time talking about that book. I couldn't think of the word for that, the shedding of the skin of the snakes. And you came back later and said, the word is,
yeah.
And now I can't remember again. But they shed that snake, and it showed new life. The snake symbolized both good and evil at the same time in Egyptian culture. The snake is in every culture. Just about every culture out there has a symbol of the serpent somewhere. And even when it's subtle, Genesis, the serpent in the garden, that's subtle. It ties into all the other mythologies and religions that have the serpent. The Chinese have the serpent in the form of the Chinese dragon. He's happy, fertility, the bringer of life. Because of the resurrection. And I think this was part of why the Egyptians worshiped the snake, because they were so high on the eternal name and the eternal life, the afterlife. And the snake symbolized resurrection because of the shedding of the skin and the new life. So
it's molting, by the way.
Ever present.
Molting of the skin.
Yes.
Okay, hey, thanks for that call there, Mike. Let's go to Jeff in Culver City, California. West of the Rockies. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Hi, George and Mr. Roberts. Yes,
hello.
You mentioned the children of Israel many times tonight, but there were people, you know, they weren't children. But in the book of Revelation, in chapters 2 and 3, Jesus Christ came back and told John on the Isle of Patmos that he knew who the real Jews were, and those who are not Jews are part of the synagogue of Satan. Jesus said this twice. So if the real Jews are Ethiopian Falashas, then the not real Jews are the ones who came from Europe and are in Palestine, or what is called Israel presently, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, sure. You know, to state emphatically that the real Jews are the Ethiopians is a theory, a religious theory, if you will. Jesus didn't say that in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation, of course, was the work of John's visions on the Isle of Patmos. If I were a cynic, I would say they were the dreams and the visions and the drug-induced or alcohol-induced visions of an old man who was in bondage or in prison on the island. That's how some people characterize it. Revelation is a hinky book. There's a lot of stuff in there, And there's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of religious symbolism in that book. And when Jesus was talking about that, Jesus in his deified state, this is John talking about Jesus after the fact. He's in heaven, and he revealed this to him. And Jesus is talking about who were the real Jews, the ones who accepted the Messiah, according to John's book of Revelation. And the false ones were the ones who did not. And that, of course, is purely the sect of Judaism that became known as Christianity. And so you start digging into the book of Revelation. I had a conversation with somebody the other day about the Jews and some of the weird stuff that comes out about the Jews. The conspiracy theories around the Jews are incredible. Somebody said something about the race of the Jews. And I said, well, let me remind you, the Jews were not a race. Judaism is a religion. The race was Semitic peoples.
Right.
And so that's how you have to filter this stuff. When you see all of this.
It's like saying the Catholics.
Right. There is no Catholic race, is there?
No, there isn't. No,
same with the Jews.
Scotty, the Anunnaki, which Zechariah Sitchin has written about.
Yeah.
In those Sumerian texts. Did you come across any of that in your work?
I did. As a matter of fact, I think I'm going to be on Ancient Aliens this week from, they filmed me.
This is the one, huh?
At last year's Paradigm Symposium. They filmed me for this, so it's a year later. I think it's this Monday night is when it airs. Their episode on the Anunnaki, if I have my information current. The Anunnaki, I believe Moses, when he penned the Pentateuch and penned these stories we have in Genesis, used that information and morphed it to fit his own purposes. And I use this example, and again, not to offend anybody or call a jihad on my head, but Muhammad, when he wrote about, or when he established Islam, he had as mentors a Christian man, a Jewish man. They basically told him, you need to, if you want to unify the Arabic tribes, you need to, in a sense, go monotheistic. And at the time, in Mecca, there were over, 260 gods that they worshipped. And Muhammad took, I think it was Hamal, I haven't reviewed this information in my head, Hamal, who was the chief god of all these other gods, did away with the other 259 and said, Hamal shall be renamed Allah, and he will be our god. So in a sense, what Muhammad did was unify all these fighting tribes of Arabs under one god and their leader. And this is what Moses did, I believe, with Judaism. He took these people and he took all this information that was already at his hands and he morphed it and reworked it to fit what he wanted the people to know. And you look at the Anunnaki story, the story of a cast of gods, Elil and Enki-Ea, as we mentioned in the first hour. What was the basic story there? Elil said to Enki-Ea, he said, create primeval man to do our work for us, to dig our ditches and trenches, canals, to mine our resources, to till our land. And so Enki-Ea does this, and they enslave primeval humans. And then you've got, in the cuneiform text, it's got the tale of Atrahasis, the human king who lives in Eridu, the city of Eridu, whose patron god is Enki.
Hold on for a sec, Scotty. More and more calls next. Scott Roberts with us. We're going to take final phone calls on our next Coast to Coast program. Yep, Friday night into Saturday morning, and that means open lines. Welcome back, Scott. I've got to ask you about the Book of Revelation, what you think of that.
Sure. Well, the Book of Revelation, I believe when I learned about it in seminary, of course, believed that it was fact. This is God speaking to John the Apostle, the favored disciple of Jesus, and giving him revelatory eschatological information about prophetic times, and also speaking to the churches of the day, the Laodicean church, and all of these different churches. It's a weird, wild book. It takes on that tone of like the Book of Enoch, and all these books that were actually apocryphal books that were booted out of the Bible because they were so wild. This has got that Revelation has what I call the Lord of the Rings on religious crack feel to it. It's got that mystical, spiritual, otherworldly type of look to it and feel about it. And it's a book that speaks about the end times. It speaks about the great white throne judgment and the judgment of all the human beings in the sea of mankind at the end of time. And it speaks about the great millennial kingdom of God and the final kingdom of God in heaven and all of these in hell. And it's one of those books. It's got, again, even like a Dante's Inferno feel about it. And you have to read this book and say, am I going to accept these things by faith, or am I going to look at it maybe a bit anthropologically and say this is somebody within a religious sect, a sect of Judaism that became known as Christianity, that is writing about things in his old age from the Isle of Patmos and saying these are visions I was given. I think that's as valid as anybody else. We listen to Native Americans talk about vision quests and visions. We go, ooh, wow, that's really something. But when we hear it in a biblical context, we say, oh, I don't know. That's just a book of faith. I think it's the same thing. If somebody had a vision, it was part of a spiritual religious movement, the book of Revelation, and I'm talking in generalities about it because it was a fairly general question. What do I think of Revelation? I think it is a wild book. If every aspect of that book is true, there is so much symbolism in that book. It's deciphering the symbolism. You know, they talk about the beast with the 10 heads. Oh, that's NATO. Well, we don't know that for sure.
And the 666. It's
right,
a computer.
Right, the 666 element. We don't know that. The 6 was the symbol of evil or of Satan, and the triple 6 was the personification of that. What does that mean in modern day? It's symbolic talk. It's symbolism. And studying the book of Revelation could be a lifetime of work just trying to decipher symbolism, and then you'd never really know if it's true.
All right, let's take some final calls here for you. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Cole's with us. Cole, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
All right, I'm taking a course in college right now. It's wilderness wandering tradition, and Moses is a very key figure in this. And so I really appreciate the subject right now. What I'm interested in is that our perception of what God is told through these stories of our leaders who penned the books of the Bible, and it just kind of seems that like. Moses' testimony of it is through the eye of the day, if you will.
Yes.
It's very different from the God of the New Testament.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think that Moses was revealing to the people what he thought it would resonate with them, and I don't think he was wrong in giving his testimony of it. I just don't know that he was equipped with our modern understanding of it.
Well, no, and of course he wasn't. When you look at these things that are written, it's from their perspective. So one thing I said when Nephilim came out, I wrote about this in that book, was there's some things you have to take into consideration when deciphering ancient linguistic and ancient language. Number one is the way we interpret the language the same way it was used in that day, the understanding. And then you have to look at the context of why it was written. You have to look at to whom it was written and to what they would have understood in their day, which we may not have all that information. So anything written that Moses wrote would have certainly been in context to the day and to the people he was talking to.
A few more calls. Matt's in Baltimore, Illinois, east of the Rockies. Hey, Matt, go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George. How are you?
Good.
Great. Yeah, I wanted to delve a little bit further into the Anunnaki issue and the Sumerian information.
Because
if there's one thing that might, in my opinion, unite or sort of bring an end to some of the sort of battling between the different religions and all these wars that we create as humans, it's that at least Western civilization, the Islam, Christianity, Judaism, all seems to descend from the Sumerians and the Anunnaki and so forth. And
yes.
You know, as that information gets revealed, tying it into today, into the sort of, the UFO question, I'm not saying that all UFOs are the Anunnaki. That probably is a, you know, was what went on before up until, you know, they sort of scattered around the globe. And now we have more sort of farther flung space brothers types that are here. But in terms of the origin story, you know, the Garden of Eden and the Adamu, you know, the Adam, yeah. You know, with the U on the end, that's straight out of the Sumerian.
Eazden, Enki Ea, he rose up out of the yeah. great Abzu into the serpent marsh, which was known as Eazden, or Eaden, which became Eden in the Genesis.
Right. And when you take a look at the, you know, the symbol on all of our health facilities, the double helix intertwined snakes with
yes, the caduceus.
With a winged planet at the top. I mean, you're looking at the ancient knowledge of the genetics, which, you know, apparently Enki and his sister Ninhursag used to create humans in Southeast Africa 200,000 years ago to create this easily hypnotizable, gold-lusting after slave worker whose skin might not be made to be above ground, you know, in certain ways. So,
right. Well,
so
you know,
information,
I found
information
very
points back to it. And finally, if you could address that, and finally, I really would like more research and information to come out about chromosome number 2. Now, humans, to my understanding, have 23 pairs of chromosomes, while all the other great primates have 24. And yet, we're 98, 99% just like them. Well, when you take a look at chromosome number 2, and this information, I studied it online, I looked at all the science papers about the second chromosome, very clearly, the third primate chromosome has been flipped upside down, fused artificially to chromosome number 2, yielding 23, one fewer chromosomes. And you know this because there are telomeres or telomeres that are only on the outer edge of chromosomes, which you can see vestigial telomeres at the center. And at the same time, about 100,000 genes apparently also appear. Now, they can go on and on about this was just an accident of evolution or what have you, and that, you know, some kind of virus was hanging around at the same time, and that's where those genes come from. But, you know, my, you know, intuition and life experiences and all the reading and the work of Zachariah Sitchin and on all points to a very clear, you know, evidence that we were created, you know, right down there. That's why the gold, the Krugerrands are from that same spot, because they were gold mining out of Southeast Africa. Take that gold back up to the Middle East and then blast it out of the Sinai with Jerusalem as the command center. Hence why everybody battles over Jerusalem. I mean,
I want to hit one thing that you said without getting into all the chromosomal talk. That's an hour discussion right there.
That's a week discussion.
Something very interesting I found out in strict context to Moses here. You remember the passage, George, where Moses is at the burning bush and God, and first of all, Moses says, "Who are you?" He didn't even know who he was.
He didn't know.
And then he said at the end, he said, "Whom shall I say sent me?" Mm-hmm. And God uttered that famous line, "You tell them, I am sent you. I am that I am. And we always interpreted that as they wouldn't say the name of God, and I am that I am they speak of. Well, now, recent linguistic study, not even recent, linguistic studies of the term I am reveals a wordplay that Moses was using, and it's an ancient wordplay that's a wordplay of another ancient wordplay. Cutting to the quick, I am literally meant in wordplay the term Enki. So in this sense, what God is saying in the book of Exodus, I am that I am, he's saying, I am that Enki they speak of. Now, what do we do with that? Is God equating himself to Enki, or is he saying Enki wasn't the God I am? You know, we don't know exactly what the context there was, but the wordplay was ancient Sumerian for the name Enki.
Which Sitchin believes came from Nibiru.
Exactly. And he was the god who created
mankind.
The primeval men.
That's right. In his laboratory.
In his laboratory, right.
Let's go to Union in South Carolina. Charles, take it away. Hi, Charles.
How you doing, sir?
Good, Charles.
Yeah, I'd like to know, just two little questions. When you talk about, like, other theologians and stuff of that nature, who, like, read other books to try to explain the Bible, and my Christian family and friends, they think I'm kind of on the nut side, because to me, it actually arguments the Bible's purpose.
Well, it does. And I think the great danger we have within our religious circles is that we say, my faith is the only true faith, and everything has to be filtered through that. Now, if you believe that by faith, that's great. That's what you believe. But when you're trying to decipher these old stories and history through that filter, that's the danger of it, because it's filtered through your theological base. There are many other things that describe these same things and even mirror these same things from different cultures and different religious points of view. So, I think the danger that I've run into, especially, and what kind of drove me out of what I was in when I was in ministry, is that whole idea that what we have is true and this is the only truth that is there. We have no proof for it. We believe it by faith, and everything else must align with this or it's wrong. That is problematic. It might be true, but it's problematic from a research standpoint.
Is it your theory that many things that we read in Genesis did not happen that way?
No, it's my theory they didn't necessarily happen the way we see them in Genesis. I believe Genesis is a version of those events. I say the Nephilim in Genesis, that is the sons of God, the Elohim, those are the Hebrew or the Israelite versions of things that happen in every culture, experienced them, and every culture wrote about them. I say they either 6,000 years ago, every ancient culture got together for some big ecumenical conference, and they all smoked the same peyote and went back with the same story, or they all experienced the same things from different perspectives. So I believe the stories you find there are rife with supernatural activity, paranormal activity, if you will, alien activity. The only thing about that is that it's the one version of it that you find in the book of Genesis. There are many other versions.
Ben is in New York and now on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, I don't know if any of you guys ever noticed, but you were talking about the Caduceus before. And I don't know how ancient that symbol is with the two snakes intertwined, but it seems to me it looks like a DNA molecule, a double helix. And if you're talking about genetic manipulation, how did they know in ancient times what a DNA molecule or a double helix looked like?
Well, and
there it is, the symbol of ancient symbol of medicine.
The thing you have to do with that, though, is say that is the connotation we, from a modern standpoint, have put on that. Was that to them the genetic code? Or was that to them just two snakes wrapped around a pole? You have to look at the context in which they would, that's a whole study in itself. Where did the Caduceus come from? How did we get it, and why did we get that to use that for what it is today? I believe it came from the serpent on the pole that Moses rose in the wilderness, plus lots of other connotations that were given to that snake on the pole many years prior to that.
So do you doubt, Scott, the Exodus, that Moses indeed scooped up?
Not at all. It happened.
Okay.
I believe there may have been more than one Exodus under Moses. I believe it took place. When we say, you look at the Exodus and you say, this is the greatest story of liberty and emancipation from bondage in human history, and it's this glorious story, but that's what it's become. We've made it into a story. I think for a bunch of slaves who I believe had their beginning as a family who migrated into the Delta region, and as I write about in the book, the Hyksos, who overtook the northern part of the Egyptian kingdom, Lower Egypt, and they established their own pharaonic line for 108 years out of Memphis, just south of what is now Cairo, and then Luxor or Thebes in the south was the divided kingdom. That it was during this time that Amos the First, he came to the throne, and he and his father wiped out the Hyksos and drove them out of northern Egypt, and they reestablished the joint monarchy. And in the biblical account, it says, and a new pharaoh rose to the throne who knew not Joseph, and the whole story of the Israelites coming to Egypt, and he said, these people, this remnant, these Asiatics that came from Canaan, these Hebrews, as the Bible calls it, let's put them into harsh bondage, lest they rejoin our enemies and rise up again against us. I think this is a good cornerstone for dating some of the events in the Bible. because I believe that is when the Israelites came into bondage. And that is not such a far-fetched story. And then a liberation from bondage, I believe it's happened. We've seen it happen before all through history, different kinds of liberations from bondage. This was a people group that one guy came in and said, let's get out of here. And he went head-to-head with the Pharaoh, and he led those people out, whether it was by miraculous events, or different things that have John places the Exodus and the 10 plagues firmly on the breaking of the wall of Lake Malkata in his theory, which he's found papyrus that identifies almost all 10 of those plagues just from the aftermath of the breaking of that huge sacred lake that wiped out like a tsunami the village of Thebes. And so there are actual events, I think, that happened that prompted this story, and I believe it really happened.
Let's go to Ray, driving in New Mexico. Squeeze you in here, Ray. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. Interesting program. I'd like to make a couple of comments.
Let's take as many as we can until we have to go. Go ahead.
Okay. The first one is are you familiar, sir, with the research of Ron Wyatt regarding Mount Sinai?
Yes, I am, and his location of Sinai and so on.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And Noah's Ark, too.
Yes.
Many people believe that that's the real Mount Sinai, obviously, but we don't have to belabor the point.
Got a lot of earmarks that look like it could very well could be.
Uh-huh. Okay, I'm very interested in the fact that you came to the conclusion that Moses was a pharaoh, because
I didn't come to that conclusion.
After studying it for a while, came to the conclusion that he was a pharaoh around 1500 BC.
No, I didn't come to that conclusion at all. I think he was trained. I believe he was a grand vizier under the pharaoh Hatshepsut. But I don't believe he was a pharaoh. I used a bit of a wordplay, and I said, I believe Moses established himself as the pharaoh god of Israel.
I got to tell you, Scott, fascinating research, my friend. Good luck with the book, The Exodus Reality. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.